This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, Creatures of Giving. In September, the Poetry Foundation announced the winners of this year's Lily Rosenberg Poetry Fellowships. The fellowship has been around since 1989, and it has grown from an award that would go to just one lucky creative writing student, to two, to now five winners, student or not, as long as they're between 21 and 31 years old. Luther Hughes is one of this year's winners, selected by a committee of about 20 staff and former fellows. He's a poet from Seattle and the founder of Shade Literary Arts, an organization by and for queer writers of color. He also published a chapbook titled Touched, which came out in 2018, and has since been working on his debut collection, A Shiver in the Leaves, expected in 2022. His poems sit close to the body and don't shy away from making the thrill and pain that comes from giving yourself wholly felt. On that note, I probably need to tell you that we mention sex and sexual molestation. Nothing graphic, but now you know. Okay. So here's my conversation with Luther Hughes. I wanted to start with beauty. Because I'm really struck by like how much beauty seems to matter in your poems, even in the ones where you talk about quite ugly things. And so I'm trying to get to the source of that. When you were little, do you know what person or thing or place really opened you up to beauty?
Good question. So I am born and raised in Seattle, Washington. And Seattle is a very green place, very robust with nature, that kind of just sits in the middle of cities, right? And so there's a lot of trees. You can always see the mountain. You can always see the water. And so there was never a time growing up where I wasn't surrounded by beauty. And so for me, when I think of beauty, I start thinking of my environment and what that means to me, both in nature, but also the cityscape, the city environment, how the two kind of exist hand in hand in Seattle. And so that's probably my first inspiration of beauty. Other things that I guess kind of influence my idea of beauty, I would say, is the body. I have a very, very early memory of things happening to the body, whether that's seeing my father have a heart attack, whether that's praise dancing. And so I was very exposed at an early age to what the body can do, both from trauma and also from just happier and positive events. And so that's also what I think of as far as beauty, right? The body is, to me, is a beautiful thing. In so much that I almost considered going into medicine to study the body more. That's kind of the first kind of inspirations of what I think of as beauty or beautiful.
That is so interesting. I mean, because when you talk about your father having a heart attack, that taught you something about beauty. Can you take me back to when that happened, like how old you were and what beauty did you see?
Yeah, so I remember this very, very vividly. I was about 5 years old. I remember my mother and my father were kind of just like kicking it outside the house. My dad was playing, his favorite song then was I Love It When You Call Me Big Papa. And so he was playing that in the house while I was inside. He was outside, kind of just like flirting with my mom and, you know, bumping up with her. And he kept going in and outside the house over and over and over again. He was too cold inside, too hot outside. And then at one point, he just collapsed outside. It was a very, very sunny day. The house was surrounded by beautiful, beautiful tall trees. The grass was very, very green, but he happened to collapse on the concrete outside. And I remember my mother just yelling, call 911, call 911. And so for me, even though it's a very scary experience for a five-year-old, what was beautiful to me was with their interaction. I remember very vividly seeing my father's arm against my mother's arm, them laughing, you know, their skins like glowing and glistening in the sun. I remember vividly going to the hospital, seeing my mom, like, her body kind of cave in with sadness, seeing my dad in the hospital, laid on the bed. And so for me, again, seeing the body do these vastly different things, one from being happy and, you know, bumping and dancing to being caved in and on the bed. Mm-hmm. That was like one of my early memories of like, wow, the body is so beautiful.
And did you know about death? Could you already figure that that was a possibility?
I doubt it. Like, I'm sure I wasn't like, oh my God, my dad is about to die. I cannot, of course, comprehend what death is or may look like. All I could comprehend was what the body was doing, right? Yeah. And because at a young age, I have other traumas with the body, from like molestation to receiving a car for a birthday present when I was like 3 years old and having the car kind of run into me. So I have other traumas with the body that when I got to that part, I knew the body was doing something visceral to me. And so it was very, very striking to see the immediate change in the bodies around me and the bodies that I knew to be close to me.
Oh, I see. That you could see the emotions play out in the way people were holding their bodies.
Yes,
rather exactly. than that they had to tell you, like, this is how I feel.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Do you feel like you are expressive with your body?
I do feel that way. So I have also a dance background. I danced probably for 8-9 years professionally, 16 to like 23, 24, hip hop dancing in particular. And then I ended up studying a little bit of dance in college, some ballet, some African and some modern. And so I have a very close relationship with my body. I talk with my hands. I'm talking with my hands now. I move back and forth. When I read poetry out loud, I move. When I write poetry, I move. And so, I would say I'm expressive with my body.
You say you move when you write poetry?
I do. I move, not a lot of movement, it's a subtle movement. And also because I read out loud when I write poems as well to make sure that my breath is doing what the page is doing. And so I end up moving when I'm writing to make sure that the rhythm is correct and make sure that I'm actually putting what's on the page that's the most accurate to what I'm thinking of in my mind.
I want to pick up on something that you said earlier when you said that you've also experienced trauma through your body. You mentioned molestation and you write about it quite a bit in your poetry, which I know does not equate being comfortable with talking about it. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to when you don't want to. But if you are, who was this person who did this to you and what happened?
Yeah, I'm comfortable talking about it now. At least I have processed it through poetry quite a bit. So this was a person who was my play brother at the time. Our families were very, very close. So I don't remember a time growing up, at least until I was maybe 6 or 7, that this person was not involved in my life. And to tell you the truth, I don't know how it happened. Like, I don't know how it started, and I don't know how it ended. I do know it was multiple times. I can also say I didn't know what it was maybe until I was about 23 or 24. And I don't remember how I figured it out that it was that thing. but it just kind of clicked on me one day, and I was like, oh, this is what that was. Because when you're 5 or 6, those type of experiences, I guess for me, are either forgotten about or blocked out or not seen as that kind of trauma. I remember it happening very, very frequently. I remember telling my mom about it, but not really knowing what it was to tell her. But she figured it out, and she was very, very upset. And I couldn't figure out why she was so upset because I didn't know what to call it yet. And so whenever I was at their house, it happened. And was there pretty, pretty frequently, possibly almost every day. And again, I don't know when it started or when it ended. I just remember it happening multiple times.
And even though you didn't know what it was or what word to use to describe it, were you clear about how you felt about it?
I don't think so. Because I looked at this person as family, I assumed that whatever was happening was okay, was supposed to happen. And even though I remember thinking this kind of hurts, like this is uncomfortable. Yeah. But I mean, when you're very, very impressionable at the age of, you know, 5, 6, by someone who you look up to, who you love, who you know spend time with, if they're telling you to do this thing, yeah, you're gonna do it, right? You're gonna go along with it. What I don't mention in any of my poems, which I think is kind of funny, is that beyond the trauma, this person terrorized me actually quite a lot. They would like sick their dog on me all the time and just laugh at me. They would like push me off of like the bike or the skateboard. Mm. But it's funny because I was never a kid that like did crazy stuff. Like I was very, very anti like roughhousing. I was not one to climb in the trees a lot. Like I would go every once in a while, but I was like, they're climbing in trees. That's kind of weird. I don't want to do that. And so I was very, very anti that type of child. I did, you know, do a lot of like playground stuff and, you know, play a lot of, you know, sports and stuff. But when it came to, I guess, boy stuff, like child stuff like that, I would, quote unquote, boy stuff. I'm quoting the air for no reason. Boy stuff like that, that wasn't me. And when I did do dangerous things, it was very, very rare off chance. That wasn't my, like, my mood, my go-to all the time. That wasn't my aesthetics. But it's funny because they would do, like, terrible, terrible things to me, but I processed that type of abuse. And I don't think I would ever put those in poems because I processed it. I understood it. You know, brothers are mean to the little brothers, right? That's not something that people talk about. But this, I have to process this because this is something that's, it's common, but it's not common. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not something people talk about or people don't say, well, that's how brothers play, right? People don't say things like that. Even though it is, I'm sure, a common thing, it's not a thing that is common for brothers to talk about, at least.
No, of course. I want to know, when you finally did have a name for it when you were older and you were writing poems, what was it like to bring this experience into the shape of a poem? Did it change how you looked at it?
Yeah. I remember actually when it started happening. I was in a craft class. It might have been like a thesis class or something like that in undergrad. And for some reason, this experience came back into my mind. And it was the end of the semester at that. And I already had created the project for the class. Like, I was already finished. And it was a very, very, I thought it was a very, very strong thesis at the time, you know, about nature and being Black in the city and about intimacy and, you know, sex and all these things that I talk about now. And one day, I think I just wrote a poem about this experience because it just came to me. And that shifted the entire thesis. I began like writing several poems about this thing within like a week. And I turned in the new thesis like a week before it was due. And when I started looking at these poems and writing about this experience, the poem started becoming very, very alien to what I was used to writing and how I laid poems on the page. I used to be but I was writing poems very, I guess you can say traditional, like left justified stanzas, you know, did all the things that a poem is supposed to look like. And then writing about this kind of opened up my idea of what a poem could be. So I began doing other things with poems that I didn't think I could do. I began talking about the body in ways that I couldn't talk about before. And so it kind of opened up a new type of way to look at poems and write about poetry that was, I don't know if exciting is the word because it's tied to the trauma, but it was exciting to see. It was weird to see that unlocking the word for me then opened up my idea of what poems could be. It's a weird feeling. Tenderness. When the festival was over, I watched the crows pluck the earth until sour. I wavered, nestled the scene inside the contour of my eyes. I wasn't a violent person. Had I been, had my feet desired the reverb of the fowl's hollow, I would have fled. Instead, I write my brother's forced sex, relax in italics. Being a beast of craft, I grew ill, gave my earth to a man with no parade in his body. It didn't matter. The man clipped my pelvis at the smile, searched for the muscle, a familiar rummaging. Outside his bedroom window, perched atop a pine tree, my brother watched the jailed underpink exposed, the swift choke flattening the neck, the flourishing of him, him, him. How wild to watch an animal die, do nothing. When I speak of cruelty, I mean do nothing. I confess, I craved my brother gutted. Let me take the crow's toothed black, bury it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that line, gave my earth to a man with no parade in his body?
Yeah. This poem is basically saying that I am haunted by what happened, right, by the brother. And I'm trying to, you know, sex my way out of it with other men.
Right. But he's outside the bedroom window, perched atop a pine tree.
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
And so when I say gave my earth to a man with no parade in his body, this is basically saying that I gave my body to a man who didn't excite me, right? There was no romance. There was no, it was only for sex, right? It was only to sex my way from my trauma. So that's what I mean, like no parade, no like aha, no, you know, no lights, no spark, yeah. No nothing. There's no parade.
Yeah. And I mean, what I also think is so interesting is like how you weave words and images from nature into images of the body, you know, like give my earth to a man with no parade in his body. What does that allow you to do?
Good question. For me, whenever I choose to compare the body to nature, usually it's earth or some type of earth like clay or something, dirt, whatever. It's because I'm trying to say we belong to the earth. At the end of the day, we go to the ground some way, right? We decompose somehow. We become earth. And so I guess I'm always trying to say, no matter how far up we go, we're always going to be tied to this thing that we're living on. We're not separate from the earth. We're not better than the earth. We are part of the earth.
Right. So can you help me understand the end of this poem? Maybe you can read it again, sort of in context with what you've just said.
Yeah. Let's see. Let me read it again for people. So I'm going to start here. How wild to watch an animal die, do nothing. When I speak of cruelty, I mean do nothing. I confess I craved my brother gutted. Let me take the crow's toothed black, bury it. And so in relation to what I'm saying about how we belong to the earth, the part where I'm taking the crow's toothed black, the crow obviously symbolizing the brother, I'm giving the brother back to the earth. In a way, I'm burying the brother alive, pretty much, is the idea. But the idea is to get over, right? To bury it, to close that chapter, to close the door, to dead the trauma by deading the brother, which is deading the crow, of course. It's almost sacrificial, right? It's almost like, here, earth, take my brother back, which I think is part of the idea, now that I'm thinking about it. But yeah, to give the brother back to the earth, to give the trauma back to the thing we're living on.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so interested in that. You do that in a lot of your poems. Use elements of nature, the wind, a crow, to write about human beings. To write about like how we interact with each other, how we, you know, love and hurt each other. And it made me think a little bit about how, you know, Greek myths where these gods are constantly sort of doing things to one another, falling in love, throwing lightning, whatever, you know. But these gods, of course, are kind of stand-ins for humans, right? Like mm-hmm. they're like larger than life humans who then allow us to see our tiny lives on a bigger canvas. And so I'm just trying to understand, like, how did you start playing with nature as allegory? Like, did you look somewhere for inspiration? Was there anyone who was instrumental in sort of helping you see that? Or how did that evolve?
I'm more than positive I wasn't always doing this. So I won't say that. I mean, so my obsession when undergrad was how a black body moves through a city. At some point in time, I had met Philip B. Williams, and he began kind of mentoring me a little bit. And so he would give me prompts. He would give me books to read. We would study works from Carl Phillips and different poets that he saw my work kind of falling in alignment with. And so at some point, Philip said to me, if you're going to write about nature, then write about nature. And I can say that the first poem that I really started digging into nature and honestly crows was the poem in the book Self-Portrait as Crow. And this is because Philip gave me, either gave me or showed me a prompt that he was doing and kind of was like, look, you should do this too. And the prompt had to do with including animals. And so I was like, I don't really talk about animals like that. I don't really care. But of course, because I want to be a better writer, I did the prompt. And I was just in love with what that unlocked for me. I was like, oh, I actually like talking about, well, crows in particular. Yeah. I like this and I want to keep doing this. Mm. And since then, I've been reading a lot of poets who incorporate nature into their work, like Camille T. Dungy and Ada Limón and, you know, all the other poets who use nature, Danica Kelly. So, like, I was like, I need to read more poets who are doing this. I remember in like the heat of a moment going to a bookstore and buying Black Nature Anthology and like learning about that and trying to understand what does nature mean to me. And what really began clicking for me is when I started writing about Seattle. And because Seattle, like I said before, is so lush and greenery and in city, it made sense then to combine my early obsession with my new obsession. But yeah, that's kind of how it began kind of talking about nature.
That is really beautiful to hear. I mean, especially because I think that there is often such sharp delineations between, like, you know, you either have urban poets and you have nature poets.
Mm-hmm.
There's a poem that I really love. It's this poem called The Wind Did What the Wind Came to Do.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have it? Do you want me to send you a link?
Because I have it.
Okay, great.
I'll read it. Cool. The wind did what the wind came to do. You've seen the tired ceremony of failed trees. You've seen the finches toss their dignity aside for the hollow mouth at evening's edge, and the humble earth saying, here, have the night. Do with it what you please. The perfect moment of love, though this wasn't love. There were bowed trees, the black clouds galloping across the sky, the wind moving as if the definition of hunger, going and going out of habit, nesting when we do when reaching a familiar field, the natural gust of the body responding to what it finds feeling, resting in the chore of passion. What if this were love? If wind bargained for beauty, let go of its kingdom. It must have a thirst for tenderness, stillness in the heart. Oh, surely the distance is closing ever so slightly. Stay inside me until the storm dies down.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
The persona bit where the humble earth speaks to the wind and says, here, have the night. Do with it what you please. Tell me about that line.
So I was thinking, so let me backtrack a little bit. I was going through a phase of when I was finding storms very, very, very sexy, very desirous. And so I don't know how this came to be. I don't know why it even came to be, but it started happening to me. And I was like, wow, storms are kind of sexy. And so whenever there was wind, I was finding myself thinking about love and sex. And so I was thinking about, well, you know, who does the wind have sex with? Who does the wind kind of get to love? And so, of course, my initial response to that was, well, the earth, right? The earth and the wind have a very tight bond, a very close knit relationship. And so I was thinking about, well, how can I express love through nature and through this wind? And for me, it was the earth giving, right? Giving the wind the night, right? Letting the wind do what it wanted to do with the night, whether that was going to be a storm, whether that's going to be, you know, a small breeze, but whatever you want to do, wind, the night is yours to do so with. Mm-hmm. And I also, in the same kind of phase, I was starting to give voice to earth a lot and to nature. And so this is also coming out of that, you know, that very, very small stint of obsession.
Yeah. It's a phase, so it's over, you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to, if I think the wind is still sexy or if I want to give voice to the earth like that. I'm not sure, but I think it's over.
It's over. Well, I'm glad it happened at all. Yeah, you know, what I find so interesting about it is that writing about desire, I think, is very tricky, especially as soon as you start, you know, using body parts and stuff. Mm-hmm. You risk winning this what is that award that they give out for, like, the worst sex writing, you know?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Right, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like, there's a big risk of sounding tacky, unimaginatively pornographic. And so can you tell me about what, when you go completely the other direction, away from porn or from whatever, and you go towards, you know, like, the most elemental thing that makes up life on earth, mm-hmm. the wind. What does that allow you to see anew about desire?
Mm-hmm. I think when I do that in poems, when I completely disregard the human body and go for the elements, go for the wind, for nature, for animals, birds, what happens for me is that I begin understanding what desire is, and that desire isn't just, I mean, it's bodily, but it's more than just the body, right? It's the body reacting to the things around it and to the thing that's happening to it. And so I'm able to understand that desire isn't one way, right? Desire isn't just point A to point B. Desire is point A to point 4 to point Z to point color, you know? So it's like, it's this multiple things that really can be tied down. And so when I'm thinking about desire, or wanting to think about desire differently, I have to go beyond the body, because the body has its limits, right? The body can't do everything, but nature can, right? Nature can do any and everything and all things. My body can't be here and there, right? My body can't be in my, at my desk and also at your desk, right? But wind can, right? But the earth can, right? And so for me, yeah, it begins unlocking what desire can be and what it can do. And I think that's why I love going to nature so much in my poems, as they relate to desire, at least. Like, I want to do more than just the body, because nature does more than just the body, and therefore desire does as well.
You know, when I hear you talk about this and when I read this poem, it makes me feel like you're really on the edge of talking about faith. You know, like, the way that in religion, you know, God asks us to surrender, for instance. Like, usually that's not really, they don't usually use desire to describe that kind of surrender. You know, they usually steer clear of that. But of course, we kind of know that those things are related, right? Like, they are sort of akin. And so I'm wondering how thinking about desire in this expansive way that you just said, how that opens you up to surrender to the divine.
Mm. I love the word divine so much. So I was raised, I was raised in church.
Yeah.
I was in choir. I was in praise dancing. I would go to Bible study, Bible camp. Like I was like raised in church. My mother was a minister. My godfather at the time was a pastor. My uncle is also a pastor. And so growing up, I had a very surface level understanding, though, of what the divine or what faith is. Because when you're a child, you're kind of told how to have faith, right? You're told faith is this way and only this way. And so I had a very surface level of what religion and faith, you know, was. It took me moving away and going to college and going to church on my own to understand mm-hmm. that faith is also like desire. It's expansive, right? To be mm-hmm. in love with God, with the divine, is really to be in love. Like you have to commit yourself in a way where it's almost like a leap, right? A leap of faith. The same thing is kind of for desire, right? There's so much feeling that you have to kind of take that leap into believing it's the right thing to do and mm-hmm. it's what you want to do. And so I began understanding faith a little differently because I understood it wasn't one way. It was expansive, right? It can't be one way, right? Because that's very limiting to who you're having faith in, right? And I was taught to believe and told to believe and do believe that God is everything and everywhere. And so why can my faith not be everything and everywhere? Why is my faith so limited to this mathematical, you do this and you get this out of it, right? Because I began believing that to believe in God is to believe in desire, I was able to think about faith differently. My mother, when I was a child, I would run through the backyard while my father yanked dandelions, daisies, thistles, crabgrass, mowed, rearranged the stones around the porch, the task of men, though I didn't know. Blessed with cartoons and chocolate milk, one Saturday, I found a bee working a dandelion for its treasure the way only God's creatures can, giving and giving until all that is left is the act itself. And there's faith, too. My mother used to say in her magnolia lilt, "It comes as it comes. There's a road to follow." When I swat the bee, I plea in triumph. My father, knee-drenched in manhood, grins, and his gold tooth glistens a likely tale. And when the bee stings my ear, I run to him screaming as my mother runs outside, hearing her only child's voice peel back the wallpaper. She charms my ear with kisses. This afternoon, I notice a bee trapped inside the window as my mother on the phone tries to steal her voice to say her mother has died. I wonder if he can taste the sadness the man on TV tells the other. The bee is so calm. The room enlists a fresh haunting and the door frame bothers. To believe her when she says, as the bouquet of yellow roses on the dresser bows its head and the angles of my clay bloom with fire, it'll be okay. is my duty as son. My mother sits in the hospital in San Antonio, motherless. My mother is now a mother without the longest love she's ever known. My mother, who used to wake up before the slap of sunrise with my father to build new rooftops. My mother, who wrote, "I pray you have a great day," on stupid notes tucked in my lunchbox. My mother, who told the white woman in Ross to apologize for bumping into me as I knocked over a rack of pantyhose. My mother, who cried in SeaTac Airport as I walked through customs, yesing the woman who asks, "Is it his first time moving from home?" My mother, who looks at me with glinted simper when the pastor spouts disobedient children. My mother, who was told at a young age she'd never give birth, barren as she were. My mother, what rises inside me, I imagine inside her, although I've never had a mother leave this earth. I've never been without love.
Thank you. It's such a moving poem. The way you make love very concrete, and you have the stacking of my mother and all the things she is and did and does for you and keeps doing. There's a line here. Wait, let me find it again. Yeah. So it's about this bee who's working a dandelion for its treasure, the way only God's creatures can, giving and giving until all that is left is the act itself. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. It's funny. We're just talking about faith. And I guess when I'm thinking about the basic characteristics of being on this earth, being a human, being a creature, an animal, with other many, many actual animals, one thing that we all do is give. And we give so much that... that's all kind of we are, right? We give our time, we give our energy, we give our thoughts, we give our love, we give our anger, we give our everything. But it's always giving. Of course, there's taking, obviously, right? But that's a reactionary response to being given something, right? And so no matter what, no matter the age, we give something. And it's... this is an attempt to say that's all kind of what we are, right? That's all God's creatures are, is giving. Mm-hmm. And I'm making it sound so bad, but I actually love that about being human and being a creature on this earth, that at the end of the day, the only thing that we can do and are able to do is to give. And that could look differently, of course, creature to creature, as in the bee, you know, giving to the dandelion, and vice versa. To me, my mom giving love to me, the same way I might give anger to somebody else. And so, at the end of the day, we're just creatures of giving, I think.
I mean, it really, what is so beautiful about that to me is that you don't make it this sort of syrupy, sugary thing, giving, you know, like you are pretty honest about, we give rage, we give a whole lot of bad things. Like even the bee gives its sting to your ear. Mm-hmm. It's not all good. But I feel like your poems pull towards beauty, even the things that are not beautiful in themselves. And so my question is, as a poet, what do you feel is the biggest thing that you can give?
I want to just say myself, but that doesn't feel like it's enough detail. So I guess the biggest thing I can give is the truest part of me in that moment. Whether that is my anger or my rage, whether that is my violence, right? And so to think about when I sit down to write a poem, I always ask myself, am I giving the most honest gesture towards what I'm talking about? And for the mother poem, am I portraying my mother accurately? Am I portraying myself accurately? Am I portraying what I'm trying to say the most accurate way? And I can't just talk about loving, right, my mother, because that's not always, I always love her, but I don't always like her, you know? So that's not always accurate. And I don't always dislike her. And so how can I do both? Oh, I have to talk about both. Nothing else can beat that, because it's the truth. It's true. Yeah, yeah. That's, I would say, yeah, myself.
Well, I have sort of like a follow-up question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can imagine that if you're a poet, that it's sometimes difficult to explain to yourself or to like justify to yourself that that is enough, you know?
Mm.
And so what I'm trying to understand is when you have these times when you're really feeling low about how big the problems are and how small you, what is something that you feel you can always give that you keep returning to over and over again?
I think the one thing whenever I feel hopeless or feeling like I can't claw myself out of a dark place, I always remember the feeling of love, what that feels like to give it and also to receive it. But for me, more so giving. Because I have a bout of depression, have depression episodes. Receiving love doesn't always put me out of places, but giving love always makes me feel so happy. And so when I am feeling hopeless, I remember how it feels to give love, whether that's to, you know, my boyfriend or my mom, whether that's to myself, whether that's to coworkers or friends. And so that is the first step to pull me out of, a darkness or a deep, deep hopelessness.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have one last question. Close to the beginning of the pandemic, you started a relief fund for queer writers of color, which I think is one of the most concrete ways of giving love that you probably could have at that time. I'm wondering, can you tell me a little bit about what this is, how you got started, and what happened?
Honestly, it started just because it was very, very impulsive. Not going to lie. It was very, very impulsive. I felt like people needed help. People are in a crisis. I was lucky enough to have kept my job, but others weren't, right? Others lost gigs. Others couldn't do their book tours. Others couldn't teach. And so I was like, well, I need to help people, right? So literally, I looked at another fund. It was the Seattle Artist Relief Fund, started by IGOMA out here in Seattle, Washington. And so I looked at that fund and I was like, okay, how does she do this? And I emailed her. I was like, hey, how did you figure out, you know, what to give and all these things? And so she, you know, gave me her answer. We did it this way. And so I just kind of mimicked what they were doing over there. And my main goal was to get it out in the world fast, quick, and people could, you know, apply for funding and all these things. And so there was little to no actual planning. I had a friend call me, was like, how are you doing this? And I was like, honestly, I don't know. I don't know how this is happening. I don't know what to do. And he was like, okay, let's talk about this. And I was like, okay, cool. So we like talked it through. He just asked questions. And then I also asked questions. We kind of figured out how to make it more, have more structure.
Okay.
And so since then, and I don't have the number next to me, but since then we have given over 160 artists a total of over $40,000.
Wow.
It was just word of mouth pretty much, and sharing on social media and people reaching out and asking questions. And so it really took the community. Like, of course, I started the fund, but it took the community to keep the fun going. People say, you know, you helped people a lot. And I was like, I honestly didn't do anything but give a platform and create a thing. It was really the people around me in a community who put money in pockets because I didn't donate that much money myself. You know, I donated some money and like, you know, made up some, you know, rounded out numbers to give out to make sure it was a nice number. But I didn't give myself $40,000, right? That's crazy.
You don't have that lying around? Oh, no.
Right. So it really took everybody to create this thing. And I'm very, very happy that people were able to get funding and get some money in their pockets during this time.
Yeah. Did people have to apply for like, oh, I'm in need of money? Or how did it work concretely?
I created a Google form for the application. And I asked them, I also prioritized trans women and disabled riders. And so they were prioritized first. And I asked that question, like, you know, how do you identify, with letting them know, like, if you identify this way, you are prioritized to receive funding. And then I asked them to kind of explain, you know, what they lost. And then I asked them, what are they requesting? There's a formula I created that is slipping my mind right now, but it's based off of the donation we got and then also what they're requesting and also what they lost. And that number is put into the formula, and then there's an output. And then whatever the output is close to the increments I set up, which were $100, $250, and $500, whatever the number is closest to, they get that funding. That's kind of how, people apply, and then that's how, it all works.
It sounds like a lot of work, though. Did you do that part alone?
Yes. I keep telling myself to not do things by myself. And people always offer to help me. And I always say, yes, I will get back to you. But yes, I read out the applications myself. I put in the formula. I, you know, created the spreadsheet. I sent the money. You know, I did all that myself. And I honestly do not want to do that ever again and don't recommend anybody to do it.
And did people who received funds have any way to get back to you and share what it did for them to get that money?
I mean, so I sent funds and I tried to make it really as accessible as possible. So I asked people, you know, they prefer PayPal, Venmo, or Cash App. And so people told me what they preferred and I sent them through that preferred method. And I don't think PayPal does this, but Venmo and Cash App, you can respond to money that you're given. And so people have said, thank you, or I needed this, so thank you so much. Or, you know, just even like just hearted the payment. And so people, have responded with thanks and just heartwarming messages.
Right. But you don't have a sense of like concretely how it affected someone's life day to day or...
I don't know. And, you know, I don't really need to know, to be honest. I don't. And I think about like even people have also asked, you know, what if they're fake? What if it's like they don't need the money? They applied anyway and you gave it to them. And I was just like, that's not my bridge to cross. Like if they scammed me, they needed the money for something. So they got the money. Like I just don't need to know how it affected people or, you know, the level of detail it affected them. I don't need to know if they even used the money for what they were asking for. I just, as long as I helped people some way, that's perfectly fine with me.
Luther Hughes is one of the five winners of this year's Lily Rosenberg Poetry Fellowships, together with Isabella Borgeson, Saray Jarrell Johnson, Daria Simpson, and Kathy Zhang, who I'll talk to on an upcoming episode. Hughes is the author of the chapbook Touched, which came out in 2018, and is currently working on his debut collection, A Shiver in the Leaves, which will be out in 2022. He's the founder of the literary organization focused on empowering queer writers of color called Shade Literary Arts, executive editor for The Offing, and he co-hosts the Poet Salon podcast with Gabrielle Bates and Duji Tahat. Besides the Ruth Lilly Fellowship, he also won this year's 92Y Discovery Poetry Prize. He lives with his boyfriend in Seattle, where he teaches at the nonprofit community writing center, Hugo House. To find out more about his work, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot. And this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.